Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 19th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, understanding learning deficits at puberty, a three-dimensional invisibility cloak, and the Nile Delta's sinking future. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about tracking criminals by their bacteria from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
During puberty, the body undergoes all kinds of changes and releases all kinds of hormones. Researchers already know that during this time, certain learning and cognitive processes decline, recovering again in adulthood, though maybe not to the same level as they were before puberty. But researchers don't know the mechanism behind this cognitive deficit. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Cheryl Smith and colleagues report the critical role for receptors called the alpha-4 beta-delta GABA-A receptors in the mouse's brain in shaping learning deficits at puberty. In addition, the team reports that the stress steroid called THP reverses the learning deficit. Mice in puberty that couldn't learn a spatial task could when given the steroid. I spoke with Smith from her office at the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center.
What we had found in mice was that there is a learning deficit at puberty compared to how well the animals learn before puberty. And this deficit is actually due to increased expression of a relatively rare form of a GABA-A receptor that mediates inhibition in the brain. And this increase in inhibition actually makes it harder to generate the signals that are necessary for plasticity and learning. And that we don't see this in animals that can't express this receptor. But what was especially interesting about our findings is that our novel inhibitory GABA receptor is a target for a stress steroid that is able to reverse the deficit. So that, in fact, with a certain amount of stress steroid, you can end up at puberty with normal learning.
What learning task did you and your team give the mice to learn?
This is a spatial learning task which was developed by a colleague of mine here at SUNY Downstate, Andre Fenton, and it's a task that requires a part of the brain that's important for memory called the hippocampus. This is a spatial learning task where the animal is trained to avoid a sector on a rotating platform. The sector delivers a very mild electric shock that's subthreshold for stress. And you don't see an increase in stress hormones with this shock. But in fact, it is aversive, so the animal tries to avoid it. As the platform rotates, the actual electrified sector is stationary with respect to the room landmarks. So in order to learn the task, the animal has to learn to discriminate between the room landmarks versus the arena landmarks. It's a rather sort of high-end type of spatial learning, and it's more difficult than other types of spatial learning tasks.
And a normal mouse can do this? A mouse not in puberty, that is?
Right. Our mice that were tested before the onset of puberty learned very quickly. Typically what we do is we first put them on the platform without the shock to just acclimatize them, and then we train them over 3 10-minute sessions. And typically, the mice that are tested before puberty learn between the first and the second session to avoid the shock. They learn very rapidly. In contrast, the mice that were tested right after the onset of puberty don't learn even across the three sessions, unless they're injected with a stress steroid.
What does this stress steroid normally do in the mouse?
This stress steroid, and I'm talking about a stress steroid called THP or allopregnanolone, it actually typically acts to enhance inhibition at GABA-A receptors. And this has been known actually for quite a few years now. So typically, its action before puberty and in adults is to worsen learning. And other investigators have actually looked at this steroid in adults, and they've reported that it actually makes learning more difficult. And we found this also to be the case in our mice that were tested before puberty. But there's a switch at puberty where it then makes learning better.
So what is the special thing going on in puberty that makes this stress steroid work better at facilitating memory when during the rest of the mouse's life it makes the mouse worse at learning?
That's because of the particular receptor that suddenly emerges at puberty. And this is alpha-4 beta-delta GABA-A receptors that emerge in a part of the brain that's important for learning. That's the hippocampus, the CA1 hippocampus. This area normally has very, very low expression of this receptor. And this receptor is interesting because it's very, very sensitive to the steroid THP, the stress steroid. But the effect of the steroid also depends on the direction of the chloride ion that's passing through the receptor. So that normally, many places where this receptor is expressed, chloride ion flows out, and here the stress steroid would actually enhance inhibition. Enhancing inhibition typically worsens learning. But at puberty, at least in this part of the brain, alpha-4 beta-delta GABA-A receptors suddenly emerge, and chloride ion is flowing in to the neuron, and under these conditions, THP decreases inhibition. So typically, decreasing inhibition improves learning because it enhances these excitatory signals that are necessary for forming the various changes that occur during learning.
How do you and your team know that these receptors and expressions are indeed what's going on in terms of learning or the inability to learn?
Well, we have some more direct and more indirect ways of figuring out how important this receptor is. One of the things that we've done in addition to learning per se is to use an in vitro model of learning. It's called long-term potentiation. And in this model, you use electrophysiological techniques to stimulate the hippocampus in a slice, the hippocampus being the part of the brain that's important for learning. And you see how well you can make the hippocampus give you a bigger response, hence the term long-term potentiation. What we have found is that before puberty, we get very robust long-term potentiation, which people call LTP. But at puberty, we actually are not able to induce LTP. Now, why do we think this receptor is responsible? Well, one thing you can do is you can actually block inhibition, put on a GABA-A receptor blocker. And when we do that, we see the same robust in vitro learning, LTP, before and after puberty. So that suggests that the deficit in learning at puberty is due to GABA-A receptors. But the second thing we did is we used mice that could not express delta containing GABA receptors. These are delta knockout mice. And in fact, when we use these mice, again, we don't see any deficit in LTP at puberty. When we did the actual behavioral experiment looking at learning, we see the same thing. The deficit in learning at puberty is no longer a deficit if we look at delta knockout mice. So the inability to express a delta-containing GABA-A receptor means that the mouse goes into puberty and doesn't lose any of its ability to learn.
Is this at a basic research stage, or do you and your team have any applications in mind?
Well, it's been known for a long time that certain types of learning are easier before puberty. And there's some very recent studies, longitudinal studies, which have looked at children all along and find that there's a change sort of in the way they perceive input at puberty, where there's a slower response that recovers after the pubertal period, sort of in later adolescence. So there is evidence that this may be true, at least to some extent, in humans. So it'd be interesting to think about ways perhaps to devise, tools for learning and cognition during adolescence that might target this specific receptor subtype and perhaps lead to, improvement in learning, especially among adolescents who might already have learning issues, learning disabilities, for instance. There are reports that these learning deficits during adolescence are greater, whereas children, say, who are gifted might not experience any kind of a deficit at all. So it all relates to what the baseline learning potential is.
But it's not as if you're going to say, well, hey, this is a pharmacological intervention here. We can inject kids with a steroid and suddenly they'll start learning better?
No, I'm definitely not advocating that. But what I am saying is that perhaps for the future, getting more information about how to manipulate this receptor might be useful, especially for people with learning disabilities. Injecting someone with a steroid, I think, would not be the appropriate thing to do.
Okay, fair enough.
There is one other point, though, which is that the results indirectly suggest that perhaps a little bit of stress is good for you, and this wouldn't mean anything about injecting drugs or using a pharmacological approach, but the kind of stress that has been shown to improve learning, if you look through the literature, is stress that has to do with motivation and internally, you know, motivated kinds of stress where people care more about doing well, and perhaps therapies that are targeting that kind of motivation stress might be an interesting approach.
Cheryl Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheryl Smith of the State University of New York Downstate Medical Center, or SUNY Downstate, on the critical role for the alpha-4 beta-delta GABA-A receptors in shaping learning deficits at puberty. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission, or FCC, released a long-awaited national broadband plan on Tuesday in response to congressional demands in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The plan seeks to expand and ensure high-speed internet access and to address gaps in access between regions and groups in the U.S. One goal, says the FCC, is that the United States should lead the world in mobile innovation, with the fastest and most extensive wireless networks of any nation. If the plan succeeds, the estimated 100 million Americans currently unable to access broadband from their homes would have download speeds of 100 megabits per second by the year 2020. There would be subsidized services for the poor and for rural areas. The plan focuses on establishing efficient, transparent markets that would allow private competition to flourish. The FCC proposes auctioning roughly 500 megahertz of wireless spectrum to broadband providers over the next decade. However, portions of that 500 megahertz of spectrum are public airwaves, the rights to which are held by private broadcasters who receive them free of charge. The FCC plan depends on being able to incentivize broadcasters to voluntarily give up those rights, though this is likely to meet resistance. In particular, the National Association of Broadcasters has already expressed concern that many aspects of the FCC's plan may, in fact, not be as voluntary as originally promised. Many questions about the plan, and even about FCC jurisdiction, still remain, and congressional examination is scheduled to begin on March 23rd.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Hiding an object with a cloak had been the stuff of science fiction and movie magic, and until now, scientists had only been able to hide an object in a plane, that is, in two dimensions, meaning that these hidden objects would be immediately visible when viewed from the third dimension. In a paper published online by Science, Tolga Ergin and colleagues have designed and built a three-dimensional invisibility cloak that hides a bump in a gold mirror for viewing angles up to 60 degrees in three dimensions. I spoke with Ergin from his home in Germany. Ergin works at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology.
I think our team succeeded in pushing the results of transformation optics one step further, because we realized the three-dimensional structure and we realized the cloaking structure in three dimensions. And cloaking structures have been very exciting to mankind for a long time. And we were the first now to show that this, which has been shown already in two dimensions, can be brought to third dimension.
What strategy did you and your team use to design your three-dimensional cloak?
This three-dimensional cloak is based on a design going back to Sir John Penry, which is originally a two-dimensional design. But we showed with numerical calculations that also an effect in three dimensions is to be expected. So we used that design, which is originally for two dimensions, which was already shown experimentally in the microwave regime and also in the optical regime by other groups. And we used that blueprint to fabricate a three-dimensional structure.
And what did you make that structure out of?
The structure is composed of a photonic wood pile structure. This means it is a polymer. It's a commercially available polymer which we write with a laser into a photoresist. So we can write nearly arbitrarily 3D structures. And it is composed of very small, tiny rods with a diameter of a few hundred nanometers. And this gives you a wood pile structure, which has a locally varying filling factor. So the ratio between polymer and air is changed locally in space. And by choosing the right distribution of this local filling factor, you can achieve the wanted cloaking distribution, which you need to make this bump invisible.
So you were cloaking a bump.
Exactly. So it is, imagine you would have a mirror, and this mirror has a little bump in it, and you can hide something underneath this bump. But of course, you would still see the bump as the reflected image is distorted because of the bump. So what we did is we put the cloaking structure on top of this bump, so the mirror again appears flat. So you cannot tell that there actually is something beneath that mirror.
Is it something about this material that gets you this three-dimensional cloaking ability?
Actually, it's the technique of fabrication. It has been shown in two dimensions that these carpet cloak structures actually work, but they only work in two dimensions, or they have been working only in two dimensions so far, which means other groups have shown that if you use a waveguide geometry, which means it's just like a sandwich structure and the light propagates inside of the sandwich, so in the plane, there it has been shown that this design works and that it gives you a cloaking effect. What we have done is we have translated that 2D structure into the third dimension, and we were also surprised that the cloaking effect is still that good even if the two-dimensional design is brought to the third dimension.
So to what degree then are you building upon previous work with these wood pile strategies, carpet cloaking as you called it?
Okay. So the wood pile strategy is a strategy that we chose. It has not been chosen before. In the two-dimensional geometry, which other groups did before, they chose, for example, silicon nanorods, and they did ion beam etching, for example. But we chose these wood pile structures because our group has some years of experience fabricating these wood pile structures. And the wood pile structure just provides you the means to get this reflective index distribution that you need for the cloaking effect. So one could have chosen another structure. We chose the wood pile structure because we have some years of experience fabricating that.
And what are the range of wavelengths that this cloaking device works for?
It is surprisingly broad in wavelength. It starts at around 1.2 to 1.4 microns and goes up to 2.75 microns, which we have recorded. But we would expect the device to work for even larger wavelengths. We could just not measure beyond that because our detector is not sensitive for longer wavelengths than that. But for longer wavelengths than 2.7 microns, you would still expect the device to work, because if the wavelength is longer, then you have still an effective medium, which is given by the wood pile structure. Effective medium means that the structure of this wood pile, the geometry of this wood pile, is smaller than the wavelength. So the larger wavelength you have, the less the problem you have. But if you go to smaller wavelengths, then it gets really tricky, because at some point the light will start to see, so to say, the geometry of this wood pile structure, and you will have effects like diffraction occur.
The wavelengths you mentioned are in the infrared spectra, is that right?
Exactly. They are in the infrared, and normal telecommunication wavelength is 1.55 microns, and the cloaking effect is observed down to 1.3 to 1.4 microns.
Telecommunications as a potential application, is that what you're shooting for?
Well, you know, application is always a tough question. And for now, these carpet cloak and also general cloaking devices are just a beautiful and exciting benchmark to show what transformation optics can do. There have been proposals in the field of transformation optics for different devices like beam concentrators, beam shifters, super antennas which concentrate light into one point from all directions, and much, much more. So it's really hard to say what the future will bring in applications, but the field is definitely very broad and the possibilities are very, very large.
Tolga Ergin. Thank you very much.
I'm very pleased to have given that interview, and it was great fun. Thank you very much.
Tolga Ergin of the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology is lead author of a paper on a three-dimensional invisibility cloak at optical wavelengths. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. It took 10 years to build the High Dam in Aswan, Egypt, and it has virtually eliminated flooding from the Nile and allows farmers in the Delta to grow as many as 3 crops per year. But as contributing correspondent John Bohannon reports in this week's issue, the Nile Delta is sinking from the lack of sediment that the dam has been holding back now 50 years. And that, plus the rising sea levels, are threatening some 50 million people who make their home there. Here's John Bohannon.
The Nile Delta is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, and it's also at the highest risk for sea level change, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So I visited the Nile Delta and spoke with scientists and also experts from the government in the Ministry of Water and Irrigation about the problems. And one of the biggest problems was, how big is the problem? There was great disagreement about that. On the one hand, sea levels are rising, and the land is sinking, or subsiding, as geologists call it. But the rates at which that is happening are a subject of pretty fierce debate.
So it's not just a matter of the sea levels rising, but actual Nile Delta sinking.
That's right. So the problem with river deltas is that they're a great place to live, and they're an awful place to live. Throughout human civilization, river deltas have been prime real estate because you automatically get wonderful fertility from all of these sediments that are washing in from land, and you also have access to the sea and all its resources. The problem is that when you dam a river, as the Egyptians have done, the flooding which brings all those sediments stops because they never make it past the dam, and very wet soils of river deltas naturally sink because that water leaches out. They're very unstable. And so slowly but surely, the land under people's feet is sinking.
Is removing the dam an option?
I asked the country's science minister, and he said it's not an option. There's just no way that they can rewind history, because when they constructed this dam, which was completed 40 years ago, ever since then, the population of the Nile Delta has doubled several times, and they are now completely reliant on the electricity and the steady irrigation that's made possible by that dam. So as far as Egyptians see it, there's just no way to go back.
Has all that farming and population changed the water quality?
Well, that's another one of the big problems that the Nile Delta faces. And a lot of the scientists I spoke to said it's even worse than climate change. So for one thing, now that they have control of the flooding of the Nile, all of the pollution that's generated by those 50 million people who live there, not to mention Cairo, just upstream of the Delta, all that pollution goes nowhere because it doesn't get flushed out to sea. And it's a monumental problem trying to pipe that stuff safely out to sea. Currently, there are canals that run through the Delta called drainage canals, which are simply for transporting sewage. And a lot of the industrial waste, a lot of the highly toxic industrial waste that gets generated by the industry in and around the Delta ends up going into the same canals, and they really just end up in these big lagoons. There are 5 of them along the coast of the Delta, and they're only getting more polluted. So that's one problem. And the other problem is that all those people need to drink, and essentially no one drinks from the canals because it's considered, rightly so, to be polluted. So what they do is they dig wells and they draw water from the aquifer, which is just beneath their feet. It's all the water below the Nile that saturates the water table. The problem is if you draw too much of that water up too quickly, it's like sucking the sea into the aquifer with a straw. And so now there's what's called a salt wedge moving into the aquifer from the Mediterranean Sea into the water table, into the Delta. And it's making wells too salty to drink in some places. However, some scientists I spoke to said that's not going to be the worst problem, that there's enough pressure from the rest of the Nile Delta water table to keep the sea at bay, that it's only going to be a problem at the margins. But everyone agrees that the pollution problem is not going to go away. And without some drastic and massive engineering, it's going to make a lot of the Nile uninhabitable.
What about solutions? Are local scientists in agreement about what could be done to address all these various problems of the sinking Nile Delta?
The one thing that I didn't encounter in Egypt was a lot of agreement. I think part of that is a national character, and they told me as much. People just love to argue. But another aspect of this is that these problems are very complicated. And it's not just Egyptians that disagree. Scientists all over the world who study these problems disagree about how to deal with it. So some solutions that people are discussing just seem crazy. They seem like science fiction. There's talk of trying to block the Strait of Gibraltar with some kind of mechanical system so that the Mediterranean sea level rise was kept in check. I don't know how seriously this is really being considered, but the fact that people are talking about it, I think, indicates how worried people are. More realistically, people are talking about putting in place a system of storm surges and dikes and sand dune barriers that would protect the Nile Delta coast from the Mediterranean in a similar way that the Netherlands has protected its coast from the North Sea in what's called the Delta Works. The problem is that the Nile Delta is much, much larger. It's a much larger target, and Egypt just doesn't have the money nor the political will. It's just not clear that they'd be able to go that way.
So what, if anything, is the Egyptian government doing now to try to address this problem?
Well, they've just launched a pilot study to try and protect the coast of the Nile Delta from the sea. But scientists that I spoke to said these are really just stopgap measures. And the so-called mega projects of Egypt is what the government is really considering to be the solution. These are a series of desert reclamation projects where they're diverting water from the Nile into desolate areas to try and create artificial deltas and massive agricultural projects. The largest of these, I'd say the most ambitious of these, is the Toshka mega project. That's an area of desert southwest of Aswan, where the giant hydroelectric dam is set up. 10% of the Nile is being diverted out to Toshka to green the desert, as the government says. And they're hoping that millions of people are going to voluntarily relocate to this area. And they've offered pretty juicy deals to try and lure people out there. For example, 10 free acres of land and a tax haven. And scientists I spoke with said, tragically, absolutely no one is taking up the government on this offer, even though they've already invested billions in this Toshka mega project. The way it was explained to me by Farouk Elbaz, an Egyptian earth scientist at Boston University, is that Egyptians still consider the desert to be a place of death. He said no one would dream of voluntarily leaving the Delta and Cairo and Alexandria and the places they know and love to go out into the desert, where the temperature can reach 50 degrees Celsius. There's no community out there. There's no history of residence that would interest young people in staking their lives out there. So it's kind of a tough situation. And unfortunately, it seems that many people expect it's going to take a real crisis in the Nile Delta, with millions of people getting displaced from their homes by an environmental catastrophe, before they seriously consider relocating to the desert.
Science contributing correspondent John Bohannon reports on the Nile Delta's sinking future. In the online version of the article, find Bohannon's reporter's notebook, which includes some of his personal impressions of his visit to the Nile Delta. Here's a quick preview.
Everyone seems to be generally in a good mood, but it's very chaotic. And so it's no surprise to me that farmers like the one I met are breaking laws all the time, often without even realizing it.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about tracking criminals by their bacteria. I think the question here is, how, Dave?
Well, Rob, you know that police can already track criminals with fingerprints and even DNA samples. And the question in this study, like you said, is, can we use bacteria? And the reason researchers have latched onto bacteria is because we're literally covered with bacteria head to toe. But it's not just that we have so much bacteria growing on us. It's that researchers have found that all this bacteria that grows on us and even in us, we have tons of bacteria in our gut. This bacteria seems to be unique from person to person, at least the bacteria that's inside of our bodies, bacteria that helps us with digestion and even our immune system, seems to vary from person to person. People have different numbers of certain species of bacteria or even different colonies of bacteria altogether. We all have sort of a unique bacterial signature, just like we have unique DNA signature and unique fingerprints.
And criminals somehow leave this bacterial trace behind?
Well, that's what researchers wanted to find out. They knew that, you know, we have bacteria growing on our fingertips and on our palms. And the question was, is this bacteria as unique from person to person as all the other bacteria that we harbor? And what they did is they took swabs from computer keyboards, computer mice, things that people would touch. They collected the bacteria from them, and they tried to see if they could match it up with the people that actually touched these objects. And lo and behold, they could. They could figure out, you know, which person out of about, I think it was about just a small handful of people, had touched these objects. And then they did even something more relevant to a criminal investigation. They took these swabs again, and then they tried to match them up not only with people that that actually touched these objects, but they compared it with over a couple hundred people, nearly 300 people that hadn't touched the objects. And the idea was to sort of replicate, you know, trying to search for a criminal among a large population of people. And even when they did this, they found that they could very well match up the bacteria from a particular key, say on a keyboard, with a particular person just based on the type of bacteria that this person was harboring on their fingertips.
How long before those bacteria colonies change? I mean, every time you shake someone's hand or wash your hands, even, the colonies will be changing, won't they?
Well, you know, Rob, these bacteria can actually last on computer keyboards for a couple of weeks. That's a pretty long amount of time, especially if we're talking about a criminal investigation. And even when we wash our hands, these colonies tend to regrow fairly rapidly. So it's not like these things are just going to, you'd be able to avoid being snagged for a crime just by washing your hands. You know, these bacteria you harbor actually grow back relatively quickly.
Perhaps you've retouched your keyboard or your mouse or grabbed the same doors that you did when you were on your way in to watch.
Exactly. You're handing a lot of the same objects that you would normally. But, you know, just because this is promising doesn't mean researchers are going to go out with Q-tips tomorrow and start taking bacterial swabs off of objects at a crime scene. This is still very early. There's still a lot we don't know about the types of bacteria, the number of bacteria that grow on our skin, and just exactly, you know, especially when you're talking about potentially putting somebody in jail, researchers want to be a lot more precise with this type of technology than the level that they're at right now.
Okay, so what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of criminals, this next story is all about psychopaths.
Many of whom are criminals, I understand, but not all.
Not all. And actually, being a psychopath, even though it has this sort of conception in our popular culture of somebody who's maybe going around murdering people on the street, all psychopath really means is psychopaths tend to have two main characteristics. The first is the inability to empathize with other people, not sort of sensing somebody else's emotional state or sort of feeling what they're feeling. And the second characteristic is being very impulsive, especially with social behavior, like a lot of risk-taking or even being very aggressive. So a lot of times those traits combine to make somebody a criminal or make somebody a very dangerous person, but not necessarily so. And the question, though, when researchers are looking at these people, especially when they're looking at criminals, is what makes them this way? You know, what makes them lack empathy and what makes them so impulsive? And there's actually been a fair number of studies suggesting why these people lack empathy, but it's still unclear exactly why they're so impulsive. And that's what this new study is all about.
Some sort of measure of empathy and impulsivity among psychopaths?
Well, for this study, they didn't actually look at diagnosed psychopaths. They looked at, quote unquote, normal people, but people that had ranges of impulsivity, people that tended to be highly impulsive and less impulsive, to sort of get a sense of this spectrum. And they didn't look at empathy in this study because they feel like they've got that one pretty much understood. They really wanted to figure out more about what's going on in impulsivity in psychopaths. And they focus specifically on this system of interconnected brain regions called the mesolimbic system. And this is the system that motivates us to hunt for rewards by releasing dopamine. Dopamine is sort of our reward chemical in the brain. So you do something that you get a reward, your brain releases dopamine, you feel good about it. A lot of times when people take drugs like heroin, there's a release of dopamine, and that's part of the reason people think it's so addictive, because your brain's rewarding you for this behavior. And the researchers wanted to see, is there something rewarding maybe for psychopaths about being very impulsive that makes them more impulsive than the average person?
So what did the participants in this study do?
Well, the researchers ran a couple of tests. In one test, they gave 30 volunteers a small dose of amphetamine, which is a stimulant, and it activates the nucleus accumbens region of the brain. And this is a region that's a part of this mesolimbic system and is involved in motivation. And what they found is when they gave these volunteers this stimulant, their nucleus accumbens, the people that tended to be highly impulsive, at least as scored on a survey, tended to release a lot more dopamine than people that weren't as impulsive. And in another experiment, they had these volunteers sit in a fMRI scanner, which measures brain activity. And they had them almost play sort of a game where they would have to hit a button when they saw a white square flash. And that's also sort of a measure of like how impulsive you are, you know, how much you're anticipating that square flashing and how fast you are to hit that button. And they got rewarded for this. They got $5 if they performed very well in the task. So there was that reward built into that. And what the researchers found is that they saw much greater levels of activity in the nucleus accumbens region of these volunteers that also tended to be impulsive than in the other volunteers. And again, this was, you know, altogether, this sort of suggests that people that tend to be highly impulsive are doing so because they're getting a reward out of being so impulsive. Their brain is, you know, giving them this positive feedback that, you know, if you're really impulsive, you know, it's great. It's a very rewarding sensation for them. And so how this all ties back into psychopaths is the idea is that psychopaths are sort of craving this reward from impulsivity so much so that they'll do very impulsive things like compulsively gamble despite the consequences. And that's what makes them a psychopath in a sense, because they're doing things that would be considered antisocial, either whether it's committing a crime, hurting somebody, or hurting themselves with, you know, drug use or gambling. They're doing all these things because they're so addicted or they're so sort of primed for this reward that they're sort of cast the consequences aside.
What about dopamine's other roles in the brain?
Well, Rob, dopamine is also involved in stress. So there's the possibility that what the researchers are seeing here is not necessarily related to impulsivity. It may be other factors that are influencing this kind of psychopathic behavior. That's at least a critique that one expert raised. Researchers don't buy that. They're saying they're seeing a very nice correlation between dopamine and this impulsivity.
The critique being that the participants might be stressed while in the fMRI machine.
That's one possibility. Overall, though, I mean, this is, you know, again, we're talking about trying to understand criminals and even potentially curb criminal behavior, because in the more we know about what's going on in the brain that could lead to drug development or other types of therapies, you know, we really want to make sure we know what's going on here. And this is still, you know, early days for this research.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this last story is also a behavior story, but this time the behavior has to deal with monkeys, specifically vervet monkeys, which are these very cute, small, gray-tinged monkeys that live in South Africa, among other places, the island of St. Kitts in the Caribbean, for one. And in this study, researchers have found that among groups of vervet monkeys, members tend to pay much more attention to the females when they're trying to learn something than to the males in the group.
What are the monkeys trying to learn?
Well, in this study, the monkeys were trying to learn how to open a box that had a treat in it.
These are wild monkeys.
These are wild monkeys. And these are really hard studies to do because, first of all, for the researchers, it takes a very long time to get the monkeys used to you, especially for following them around. In this particular study, the research team had to follow these groups of vervet monkeys around for about 4 months before they could even get comfortable enough to put this box in front of them. And what they did was they put this box that had a reward inside, and there was a couple of different ways to open the box. You could pop open the door on one end, or you could slide open a door on the other end. And the researchers sometimes shut one door so the monkeys could only open it one way, or they can only open it the other way. The big thing they were trying to figure out here is this sort of big question of culture in non-human societies. You know, researchers know that other species tend to have traditions or certain behaviors that tend to get passed down from generation to generation. For example, in the vervet monkeys, they travel in groups of about 10 to 50 individuals. And some groups, if there's a conflict, they have one way of dealing with it. Sometimes they'll scapegoat somebody else to help diffuse the conflict. Sometimes they'll console the loser. Different groups seem to have these different traditions that we would almost call a culture, different cultures between groups. And in this study, the researchers are trying to figure out, you know, is there really such a culture? How is this culture passed down? That's really what they set in to find. And so they wanted to see, you know, do these monkeys have different ways of opening these boxes and do they pass down the culture?
So what did the wild monkeys do when they were presented with this box?
That was what was really interesting. What the researchers noticed is the dominant member of the group, which is usually a male, but not always, can be a female, was usually the one that would walk over to the box and start playing with it. And if the male would try to open a box and figured out a way to open the box and consistently did it that way, the other members of the group, when presented with a box, didn't necessarily replicate what the male did. Sometimes they would ignore the box and sometimes they would just sort of do their own thing, you know, try to open it in a bunch of different ways. But when the group observed a dominant female opening a box, about 80% of the individuals would try to open the box the same way that she did, showing that they were paying a lot more attention to her, that they had judged her approach the best approach, and that they, rather than try to figure out for themselves, they were just going to do what she did.
Is there some reason that the non-dominant monkeys wouldn't want to look at the alpha male?
Well, what's really interesting about these vervet monkey groups is that the females tend to stay in the same group. So from when they're born to when they grow old, they always stay with the same group. Whereas the males, when they're about 4 years old and they've reached sexual maturity, they leave and they join other groups because they're looking for mates. So these males are always in flux with the group, whereas the females are sort of, if you want to say something like this, they're almost the cultural keepers of the group because they're the constants. And so the researchers say it kind of makes sense that if you're going to pay attention to somebody in your group, you're going to pay attention to the female, especially the dominant female, because she's the one that's really the stable part of the group. She knows the group. She's always been there. You know, her descendants are always going to be part of that group. And so if these monkeys are looking for any sort of cultural stability, as it were, they're going to pay attention to the female rather than paying attention to a male that could be here today, gone tomorrow.
Do the alpha males leave?
Well, I don't know about that, but the idea is that these alpha males could have come from another group, so they don't necessarily have the cultural history that the females in the group would have.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how male seahorses abort embryos from unattractive females, and also a very big breakthrough in quantum mechanics. Researchers have come closer than ever before to creating a device, an actual mechanical device that behaves according to the rule of quantum mechanics. In other words, that it can essentially be, or parts of it can be, in two places at once, or at least in two states at once. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we've got a story about how red tape, how bureaucratic red tape, is hampering stem cell science, and also a story about future missions to Mars, what is being done scientifically to prepare us for a possible journey to the red planet. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the March 19th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.